From the studios of the Mayo Clinic News Network, this is Mayo Clinic Radio, exploring the latest developments in health and medicine and what they mean to you.
Welcome, everyone, to Mayo Clinic Radio. I'm Dr. Tom Shives.
And I'm Tracy McRae.
And welcome, everyone, listening around the country on our 160-some affiliate stations.
Welcome to the program.
Well, while we may think of bacteria as a bad thing, our intestines are full of both good and bad bacteria. Probiotics are the so-called good bacteria that may promote a healthy immune system and help with some common health problems like irritable bowel syndrome or diarrhea or constipation. On today's program, we'll learn more about probiotics from a Mayo Clinic expert.
Also on the program, understanding advanced directive laws and how they can vary from state to state.
And a recent study on lymphedema risk in breast cancer patients.
All that, along with this week's health and medical news, right after this.
Welcome back to Mayo Clinic Radio. I'm Dr. Tom Shives.
And I'm Tracy McRae.
Well, you've probably seen them advertised in yogurt and drinks and dietary supplements just about everywhere. And, of course, we're talking about probiotics.
Ooh, it's a good buzzword.
Probiotics are the good bacteria that are either the same as or very similar to the bacteria that already are inside your body. And there are literally trillions, that's with a T, trillions of bacteria in your digestive tract. Or your gut. In fact, there are more bacteria in your digestive tract than there are cells in your body.
Hmm.
So you can impress your friends with that little bit of information at the next cocktail party.
I sure will. But not all of the bacteria in your body are good for you. Research suggests that having too many of the bad and not enough of the good bacteria, caused in part by an unhealthy diet, can wreak all sorts of havoc on your body's systems. So how do probiotics work, and how do you know what's right for you? Here to discuss probiotics is Mayo Clinic gastroenterologist Dr. Joseph Murray. Welcome back to the program, Dr. Murray. We love having you.
Thank you.
Dr. Murray, glad you're here, because I want to ask you, is this probiotics thing being a little bit overdone?
Well, I think we can't overdo the importance of our friends, the bugs that live in us and on us. That's essential not only for our survival, but for evolution of our human species as a species that's been able to populate all four corners of the earth. We can adapt to the diets, to the environment, in part because of our bugs. They can change much faster than we do, and they provide us with that essential assist or support when it comes to, for example, digestion.
Dr. Shives, you've been doing this program, though, for 26 years, and it's been only within the last few years that probiotics have even been a topic of conversation.
When so, we got along fine without them.
Yeah. Well, that's not true. We didn't talk about them so much, but, you know, your grandma's sauerkraut was a probiotic. If you're from Korea, kimchi is a probiotic. There have been probiotics in use for millennia. So we're not first to this game by any means. The Chinese were using this thousands of years ago.
And when you use the word probiotic, what are you really talking about?
Well, what we really mean is that probiotics are beneficial bugs. They're not pathogens. That means they're not things that are going to attack us and cause illness. They're good bugs that are helpful either for digestion or for our immune system. And you can administer them, usually taking them by mouth, and they can either be encapsulated, purified bugs that are encapsulated, or they can be food-based probiotics.
Okay, so kimchi and sauerkraut, mm-hmm. Any sorts of different fermented vegetables that you can buy now. Yogurt.
Yogurt, of course, would probably be one people are most familiar with, and there's variants of that, like kefir, for example, is another example. But virtually anything that you ferment has that potential. Now, probiotic refers to live bugs. Prebiotics, very similar, actually refers to food for bugs. Food that we eat, not so much intended for us as so much as intended for our bugs, that a prebiotic feeds the good bugs.
So what are those?
Well, those would be things like inulin, FAS. You'll find those in foods, non-digestible carbohydrates. So things that we, as the human, don't digest very well, our bugs do that job for us. And those bugs like those the roughage, for example, and mm-hmm. the fiber. It's the bugs that are working on those and helping us derive the benefits that we have from eating those foods.
But so the question is, though, do we need to supplement our diet with other probiotics like yogurt or some sort of pill? Or isn't the flora that we need inside our gut naturally there as a result of our routine diet, normal diet, good diet?
So that's an excellent point, Tom. And I think we have done a lot to affect our bugs. And over generations, we've been killing our bugs. We've been nuking our bugs. When you take an antibiotic, a general antibiotic, yes, it's important to treat the infection. That's the bug that's trying to damage us or kill us, perhaps. But when we take those antibiotics, we're also basically declaring nuclear warfare on our good bugs.
Ah, okay.
And those are indiscriminate, largely indiscriminate. And yes, we've got some resilience in our community of bacteria. They'll grow back. But I think it's not a bad idea to help them. And then diets, we have a very narrow diet. A narrow diet for us is a narrow diet for our bugs. And bugs need to be fed.
Okay, so the prebiotic, I'm going to have to research a little bit more about that. But how do you know if the food that you're eating or the supplement, the pill that you're taking, is a good pre or probiotic, or is just something that's jumping on the bandwagon and slapping the word probiotic or prebiotic on it?
So the first thing is, these are not regulated as drugs, for example, by the FDA. They're not required to show efficacy. That's, you know, do they work for treating diseases or symptoms, by and large. So you're based partly on reputation. What's the reputation of the manufacturer? Have they published research, for example, on the use of their bugs? And just as you said, anyone can jump on that bandwagon and start manufacturing bugs pretty much anywhere. And that is a little scary.
Yeah.
Generally, things like foods, like yogurts, for example, you can taste them, you can look at them, and those tend to be generated in larger batches. So I think it's a little easier to identify those as foods. It's when they start putting things in capsules or powder form, then you wonder, well, how good were those bugs to begin with?
Mm-hmm.
But they are live bugs in those capsules?
The intent is that they are live bacteria.
Have you checked it out?
You can grow them. You can sure grow them from there. They're dried. Some of them have to be refrigerated, for example. Others work, they're called lyophilized. That means they're freeze-dried, but they will reconstitute. Bacteria, well, not all of them will come back to life, but most of them will.
And what about yogurt? I mean, because I've started to kind of read a little bit more about this kind of stuff, is it beneficial for me to be making my own yogurt as opposed to buying store-bought yogurt? Is there really a big trade-off difference?
Well, remember, store-bought yogurt has to be transported, it has to be stored, it has to meet certain taste and texture characteristics. There's a lot of additives. And again, it depends on what you're looking at. If you're looking at a very simple yogurt, I look for myself, I would look at the ingredient list. The shorter the ingredients, the list, the better I like it.
So how do you make yogurt? What's in there?
You take milk and you make yogurt out of it.
My mother made yogurt,
yep.
And she would take a little bit of starter yogurt from the previous batch, put it in containers along with whatever milk she was using, keep it at a certain temperature, allow the bugs to grow, let it grow for a few days, and you got a whole new batch of yogurt, and then keep on using that piece.
Yeah,
you know?
And I've got friends that say once you start doing that, you don't ever want to go back to store-bought yogurt because, of course, making it yourself, so much better.
Yeah. All right. We'll bring some in sometime.
You know, but listen, I want to address.
I don't want to try it, but I just would like to see it.
No, but you know what? But also, I want to address, I mean, you know, Dr. Shives, I'm not going to put words in his mouth, but he is a little bit skeptical about the importance of probiotics. Is that fair to say?
Well, taking it as a supplement.
Okay.
Yes, I'm a little skeptical.
So I do think it's important that we recognize that some of these things are not proven to be beneficial. And I would always, if a patient asks me, and that now is becoming a much more common conversation in the clinic room, is patients say, well, what about my bugs? So what I ask them, are you eating a broad diet that includes lots of fruits and vegetables, especially because those are things that bugs like. Good bugs like the fiber and residue that's present in those fruits and vegetables. And then, are they eating very high-fat foods? Because high-fat foods might actually feed bugs that aren't so friendly to us, perhaps.
Right, could have a problem.
What about sugar? Is sugar feeding the bad bugs?
We don't know that for sure. A lot of the sugar, if you take pure sugar, you're going to absorb most of that sugar in your upper digestive system. The bugs that really like the sugar are in your mouth, and our dental colleagues don't like that at all, because you feed those bugs in your mouth sugar and those produce all kinds of acids. They damage your dental enamel surface. They encourage, you know, gingival infection, gingivitis, some nasty things like that. So sugar is not so great. It doesn't make it to the colon. We want food that has fiber that will make it to the colon and feed those bugs.
Are there any patients where you have actually suggested to them that they take a probiotic?
Yes.
And
oh, yes.
Who would that be?
So there are certain circumstances where it may be helpful. It may be helpful in people with kind of inflammatory disorders in the gut. Now, I would never regard a probiotic as a primary treatment for, say, somebody with inflammatory bowel disease, but it might be helpful. I also recommend it in people who've taken antibiotics, for example. The data on that is a little mixed. There may be help in certain circumstances in children with or people with infectious gastroenteritis. You might shorten their illness a bit with probiotics. There is mixed data, and I will say there are some studies say it's great and some that say it's not. And that may be because the actual bugs matter. What are those bugs doing?
Time for a short break. Gastroenterologist Dr. Joseph Murray, we're talking about probiotics. When we come back, we'll talk to him about what Mayo's doing with regard to probiotics and the future of probiotics, these live bacteria that some people are taking every day.
You're listening to Mayo Clinic Radio on the Mayo Clinic News Network.
Welcome back to Mayo Clinic Radio. I'm Dr. Tom Shives.
And I'm Tracy McCray.
We are talking with gastroenterologist Dr. Joseph Murray. We're talking about probiotics, and we have determined that these are live bacteria. They're good bacteria, and there are certain patients for whom it is reasonable to prescribe a probiotic and as a supplement. And if you were going to do that, would you tell your patient to eat yogurt or eat these certain foods or go to the store and buy a pill?
Generally, I usually try to emphasize the food-based probiotics. So the yogurt, for example, for some like kimchi or sauerkraut, or and I think some of that might be ethnic preferences as well.
Kimchi. What is that?
That is fermented cabbage.
Yeah.
And it's very
it's just
peculiar.
Like a,
well, no wonder I don't know what
yeah,
it is.
Korean yeah, Korean sauerkraut.
Yeah, it's exactly. Huh? And it goes down in a big earthen jar in the ground
it's
for several months.
And really? I'm telling you, I never thought in a million years I would like fermented vegetable salad. Oh, Tom. That's what I'll get you for Christmas this year.
Oh, yeah, well,
Let's talk.
Yeah, we're going to skip Christmas this year.
Let's talk about what Mayo Clinic is doing in this direction of microbiomes and probiotics.
Sure. So Mayo has a major initiative in the area of microbiome. And, of course, at the Mayo Clinic, our research is very much patient-focused and patient-directed. And so there are many researchers now at Mayo who are studying the microbiome.
What is that? That's the flora of the
exactly. Our community. Think of our, in fact, the microbiome even goes beyond the gut. It's present in the mouth and our skin, and basically every part of our external or even some internal surface of our body have a microbiome. So when we think about the microbiome, we think about the whole of that on the human surface. And we have many investigators who've been studying the microbiome in association with diseases and disorders, also studying the effects of particular bugs. Are there good or bad bugs? So research I've been involved with is looking at the effect of bugs that are derived from humans to see how well they can tame the immune system. And some work that's coming out very shortly suggests that a bug derived from the human gut, delivered into the gut of a mouse, can affect the immune system far from the intestine. And so the promise of that is this is not just a gut issue. And it's not just a gut potential. The potential for our bacteria and for good bacteria may go well beyond intestinal health. It may affect the immune system throughout the body.
What I'm most interested in is, can you repair your microbiome? How much research is happening in that? And I'll tell you why, you know, because as a person who went through chemotherapy and took some hard-hitting drugs, that I would imagine did quite a number on my microbiome. I'm fascinated to learn more about how that has affected my health in all of these years as a cancer survivor and if it can be repaired.
So I think that there are several things. So diet is a very important thing for the health of the microbiome. What are we eating? And of course, illnesses can interfere with what we're eating. And it's not just what we eat, it's what we're feeding our bugs. So that's one. The second is chemotherapy and all the antibiotics and stuff does do a number on the microbiome. However, as the immune system of the person changes, so also does the microbiome change. So it's a two-way street. There's this crosstalk that goes on. And it turns out the more we do, the more we don't understand.
Yeah,
we know we don't know about this. This is a very complicated community. And we're only now scratching the surface on trying to understand some of the factors that influence it. Again, some of the things we've learned, feed people early. Try and keep food going into their digestive system. Bacteria, giving bacteria to people with a very dodgy immune system can be tricky because there has been one experience in Europe where a probiotic, generally good, was not good in somebody with a defective immune system. So we do have to be careful about administering bugs, for example. But administering foods that encourage good bugs is generally a safer general approach. But again, we're just scratching the surface.
But it must be in general, whether your microbiome takes a hit from an antibiotic or chemotherapy, that in most instances, it is able to reconstitute itself. Fair?
I think that's fair. It will reconstitute itself. However, with repeated hits, it can become quite depleted, and especially in what we call diversity. Diversity is the kind of the broad spectrum of bugs. And one very specific category is a condition called C. difficile colitis. And we've got a group here who have been studying that now for a number of years. It is a life-threatening and sometimes a life-taking illness that occurs in people exposed to multiple antibiotics or several courses of antibiotics.
And the way that is successfully being treated in a lot of cases is a fecal transplant. So you are taking someone else's biome and amending your biome with that?
Them an instant, and it is almost instant in effect. You give them an instant diversity, and I think it's one of the best proofs of how our good bugs, even if they're borrowed from someone else, can protect us from really bad players.
I sort of hate to ask, but how is it that you do this fecal transplant? I think we've talked about this.
We sure have.
Tell us.
Check the podcast.
So we do have a whole clinic and service focused on doing this. And basically it means taking healthy stool, giving it to people into the colon. And then repopulates.
From below.
From below, usually.
Okay. All right. Usually?
Usually there are other protocols for from above.
Pills.
No kidding.
No kidding. That's right. And, you know, I thought that I remember hearing that the microbiome has its own genetic code. Just like I have a genetic code, my microbiome has its own. So when we say there's changes to a microbiome, are there changes to its genetic structure as well?
Yeah, so the way we assess the microbiome, one of the ways to assess the microbiome is what are the genes that are present and what are the genes that are being used by the bugs? And that can change. And very rapidly after taking antibiotics, that will change. It will bounce back. So that gives us a very powerful tool for understanding a very complex community.
So what does the future hold?
Oh, the future is almost limitless. Some people have said that human stool is the next frontier for drug discovery. Our area, I use the term brug. Probiotic is kind of too weak a term, but I like the term brug, which means bug drug, is these bugs can act like drugs.
Well, let's say that again. The human stool
could be one of the next frontiers for drug discovery.
Well, interesting. And it may happen right in your lab. All right. Well, bring on the kimchi. Bring on the kimchi. We've been talking about probiotics with gastroenterologist Dr. Joseph Murray. What a pleasure to all have you on the program, Dr. Murray, once again. Thank you.
Thank you for having me.
Still to come on Mayo Clinic Radio, how advanced directive laws vary from state to state.
And later on in the program, understanding lymphedema risk in breast cancer patients.
Do you have a health-related question you'd like us to answer or a topic you'd like us to cover? You can tweet us anytime at hashtag Mayo Clinic Radio or send an email to mayoclinicradio@mayo.edu.
Coming up, the latest health and medical news with Vivian Williams. You're listening to Mayo Clinic Radio on the Mayo Clinic News Network.
Hi, I'm Vivian Williams with your Mayo Clinic Minute. Uterine fibroids are common. Approximately 80% of black women and 70% of white women will develop fibroids in their lifetimes. Dr. Ebby Stewart, a Mayo Clinic OBGYN, says research has been scarce, and this may be one reason why myths about the condition exist.
There are a lot of myths surrounding uterine fibroids.
Dr. Stewart says fibroids are non-cancerous growths of the uterus. Symptoms include heavy menstrual bleeding, anemia, changes in bowel and bladder habits,
habits and difficulty getting or staying pregnant. And myths about fibroids may keep some women from getting proper treatment. Myth number one, hysterectomy is the only treatment that works.
That's clearly not true.
Including less invasive procedures called focused ultrasound and uterine artery embolization. Myth two, a growing fibroid is a cancer.
Sometimes cancers can be mistaken for fibroids, but that's pretty rare.
Myth three, fibroids only affect women in their 30s and 40s.
Even if you're 24, if you're having 8 days of menstrual bleeding a month, it's appropriate to ask if you might have uterine fibroids.
And black women are more likely to develop them early. Myth four, you can't get or stay pregnant. Dr. Stewart says fibroids can make pregnancy difficult, but not impossible. And in other news, heart disease may be a leading cause of death, but that doesn't mean you have to accept it as your fate. Although you lack the power to change some risk factors, such as family history, sex, or age, there are some key heart disease prevention steps you can take to reduce your risk. You can avoid heart problems in the future by adopting a healthy lifestyle today. Here are 7 heart disease prevention tips to get you started. 1. Don't smoke or use tobacco. 2. Exercise for about 30 minutes on most days of the week. 3. Eat a heart-healthy diet. Now, a diet rich in fruits, vegetables, and whole grains can help protect your heart. Aim to eat beans, low-fat or fat-free dairy products, lean meats, fish, and healthy fats such as olive oil. Also, avoid too much salt and sugars in your diet. 4. Keep a healthy weight. 5. Get enough sleep. 6. Manage stress. And 7. Get regular health screenings. For the Mayo Clinic News Network, I'm Vivian Williams.
Welcome back to Mayo Clinic Radio. I'm Dr. Tom Shives.
And I'm Tracy McRae.
When it comes to medical care, who decides when a patient can't? Well, here's what's interesting. Fewer than 30% of Americans have what's called an advance directive, or a legal document that outlines their treatment preferences, that can also grant someone else the power to make medical decisions on their behalf. And without that legal document, a patchwork of state laws can make it confusing, to say the least, to navigate an incapacitated patient's medical wishes.
Recently, Mayo Clinic, in conjunction with the University of Chicago Medical Center and Harvard Medical School, researched the disparities in advance directive laws across the U.S. The research was recently published in the New England Journal of Medicine, and here to discuss is one of the lead authors of the study, Mayo Clinic Pulmonary and Critical Care Fellow, Dr. Aaron DiMartino. Welcome back to the program, Dr. DiMartino. It's nice to see you again.
Nice to see you, too. Thanks for having me.
So tell us about this research, Dr. DiMartino, because it sounds like when it comes to advance directives, there's a fair amount of disparity among the states. We're far from all the same.
That's correct. And it really came to light for me during the course of my training as I moved from one state to another and practiced in different hospitals. I would notice that similar patient care situations were approached differently in different jurisdictions. And when I would ask about that, I was referred to the statutes. And I don't think very many people actually go and read the statutes. But eventually, because I encountered this so many times, I decided to go look for myself. And that kind of opened Pandora's box.
Pandora's box for sure. If it's confusing for you as the physician, I can't imagine what it would be like for the patients.
Sure.
And family.
I think a lot of patients and even physicians who practice in one place for most of their careers are unaware of the degree of heterogeneity state by state.
What does that mean?
Meaning that...
That's a medical word, isn't it? Yeah, good for you.
Meaning that...
Differences.
Yeah, differences that can occur in a very similar patient encounter in one state versus if you were to cross the border 5 miles away and get your care in a different state. The same situation may be approached very, very differently.
Well, whoever made that decision that the states shouldn't all be the same and that this should be on a federal level rather than letting each state decide how they wanted to do their advance directives?
Well, this has really evolved over time as a state issue. The first advance directive laws were passed in California back in the 1970s, and since then, every state now has some kind of statute or law that addresses decisions for somebody who can't make their own decisions. Most of those are in the form of an advance directive law. But some of them also cover people who don't have an advance directive and don't have a guardian or somebody appointed by court to make their decisions. And those are what we call default surrogate decision makers. So the people who are those 70 or between 70 to 80% of American adults who don't have advance directives and don't have a legal decision maker are covered by these other laws.
What is that the key problem that you found, is that even just people having an advance directive?
It's certainly a problem that when somebody becomes sick, their doctors often don't know to whom they should turn for making decisions.
Definitely. So everybody really ought to do this, right? And there's a lot of people out there right now, all of us baby boomers, who ought to be doing it if not yesterday, right?
And I wouldn't necessarily only shine the spotlight on one generation. I would say that it's as important for a 20-year-old to complete a directive as it is for an 80 or 90-year-old, meaning that at least, at the very minimum, it's helpful for us to know who you trust to make decisions for you if you were to become suddenly ill.
Is there, after you've gone through this research, now do you feel that there should be a national standard, or do you feel like there should be a guideline or a framework for each state? Because I'm kind of like the state's rights kind of thing, but I can see how in this case it might not be the best thing.
Yeah, it really depends on your philosophy, I guess, about government in general, whether you believe that states or local communities should be guiding these types of decisions for their own citizens, or whether there should be a more universal approach. Certainly having a universal approach, say an advance directive format that was recognized in all states, which does not currently exist, or a more general approach to these types of decisions that's acceptable across all state lines, would make it easier for policymakers and people who are trying to design best practices or recommend ways of dealing with certain types of medical therapies at the end of life, if we had some kind of universal way of approaching these issues.
So from a practical standpoint, let's say that I have an advance directive in the state of Minnesota. I'm down in Florida. I get critically ill. Are you saying that the advance directive that I filled out in the state of Minnesota is not effective in the state of Florida? They wouldn't follow what I said in Minnesota?
So that's an excellent question. Almost every state has what we called a reciprocity clause, meaning that they will recognize an advance directive that's been filled out in another state that talks about different care preferences and things like that, as long as those care preferences don't carry it over the line of something that would be illegal in one state that would have been legal in your state of origin, specifically like a physician-assisted suicide type situation.
What about if you fill out your advance directive and then you retire and move to another state? You have a different home state then. Is the same situation? So, it can't be reciprocity because you're moved to a different state.
So ideally, you would fill out a new directive that follows that state's language. Some states have specific language they require. Some states actually have specific forms that you need to use. But ultimately, if there is some kind of legally documented expression of wishes, it's usually respected even though it's outside of the normal jurisdiction, just because it's actually so rare to even find legally documented wishes, patient wishes.
Physician-assisted suicide, now how many states? Isn't there four or five only?
I believe so.
So if we had that law in Minnesota and I went to Florida, they wouldn't do that in Florida, even though it was legal in Minnesota.
That's correct. Yes.
All right.
You and your co-authors, did it change the way you thought about what you're doing?
In terms of my own practice?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Certainly, because this issue comes up very frequently. Minnesota is one of the states in which we don't have this rigid hierarchy, we call, or a ladder, where you, if somebody doesn't have an advance directive, you go first to the spouse and then the adult child and then their sibling, for instance. Whereas in my co-author states in some cases they have a very rigid ladder that they must follow. And so just talking to them about the ways in which they approach similar patient situations is quite interesting, because in Minnesota, you may have 6 or 7 different people who are become recognized and become a part of the decision-making process, whereas in another state, that mantle of responsibility falls squarely on one individual's shoulders.
All right, bottom line is you got to do it. Get an advanced directive no matter how old you are, no matter where you live. Advanced directives and how they differ in different states in the U.S. with Dr. Erin DiMartino. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
We're going to take a short break. When we return, we'll discuss lymphedema with a Mayo Clinic expert. You're listening to Mayo Clinic Radio on the Mayo Clinic News Network.
Welcome back to Mayo Clinic Radio. I'm Dr. Tom Shives.
And I'm Tracy McRae.
When a woman is diagnosed with breast cancer, there are usually a range of treatment options. Now, most women do undergo surgery for breast cancer, and they usually get some kind of additional or what we call adjunctive treatment before or after surgery, things like chemotherapy, hormonal therapy, or radiation. Now, one of the not uncommon complaints for women who've undergone breast cancer treatment is what's called lymphedema, or swelling in the arm on the treated breast cancer side. Now, previously, lymphedema has been thought to be due mainly to the surgical removal of the lymph nodes in the armpit, up in the axilla, the doctors call it. But a recent study at Mayo Clinic indicates that there are multiple factors that can actually contribute to lymphedema.
The results were presented at the American Society of Breast Surgeons annual meeting. And here to discuss the lymphedema risk study is lead author Dr. Judy Bowie. Dr. Bowie is a surgeon with the Breast Clinic and vice chair of research at Mayo Clinic. Welcome back to the program, Dr. Bowie.
Well, thank you, Tracy. Thank you, Tom.
Yes, you bet, Dr. Bowie. Nice to see you. So explain to our listeners what lymphedema is and what normally causes it.
So lymphedema is essentially swelling of the arm. And as you mentioned, Tom, it happens on the side of the breast cancer surgery. It can happen anytime, essentially, over the lifetime of the patient, but most commonly will occur in the first 2 years after their breast cancer diagnosis and treatment. And it can vary from just a little bit of mild swelling, where the patients may notice a little bit of tightness of the rings, to more significant swelling, where the patients will come in and often need massage therapy or some kind of compression sleeves to try to get that fluid to drain out of the arm and decrease the amount of swelling.
And is it more common than not?
So average rates that we have tended to quote is about 25% of women will develop lymphedema if they have that full axillary lymph node dissection, that main group of lymph nodes removed from the armpit on the side of the breast cancer.
And what do those lymph nodes do?
The lymph nodes are essentially draining the lymphatic fluid. So we have lymph nodes all over our body. The ones in the armpit are draining the fluid from the breast, and they're also draining the fluid from the arm. So that's kind of why they're being evaluated. They're being evaluated to make sure the cancer hasn't spread from the breast to the axillary lymph nodes, but they are also the lymph nodes that are draining the fluid from the arm, and so that's kind of the side effect, the collateral damage.
So you have interrupted that pathway when you take out the lymph nodes.
Exactly.
And normally the lymph nodes are filters, so if you had an infection in your hand and the bacteria got in your lymph system, the lymph nodes would filter them out. Similarly with cancer, except the problem was your immune system can kill the bacteria, but it can't kill the cancer, unfortunately.
Right. And so the staging system is very much based on, you know, is the tumor limited to just the breast, or does the tumor also involve the regional lymph nodes, the axillary lymph nodes, or has it spread beyond that? And so assessment of the lymph nodes has always been an important component of cancer treatment. The progress we've seen over time is that even the women who do develop lymphedema are getting treated much more right. effectively and aggressively. So you don't see people with these elephant extremity. So I think by diagnosing it early and treating and preventing it early, that is critical to avoiding that situation.
Tell us about the study. What did you? What was the study and what did you learn?
So we've always known that axillary surgery is one of the main culprits in terms of the risk of lymphedema. And axillary lymph node dissection, which removes that main group of lymph nodes, has that rate that we've quoted of about 25%. And in general, I'll tell a patient, if you also get radiation, that risk is a little bit higher. The good news is in breast cancer surgery, nowadays, not everyone has an axillary lymph node dissection. In fact, most women do not need an axillary lymph node dissection. We're able to stage the lymph nodes with a sentinel lymph node biopsy and just remove the first few lymph nodes in the drainage pathway, those first 2 or 3 or 4 lymph nodes. And as long as they are negative, we don't need to go on to do a full axillary dissection.
So that's kind of another example of knowing better, doing better, and the patient's benefit of that over
exactly.
the years.
Exactly. Yep. Just being less invasive and doing the right amount of surgery. surgery, and bigger is not always better.
Okay.
And tell us what you mean by sentinel lymph node.
So the sentinel lymph nodes are the first lymph nodes in the drainage pathway. So we usually have the patient undergo an injection of some radioactive tracer into the breast and also some blue dye into the breast. And those both drain along that normal lymphatic drainage pathway. And then in the operating room, with our eyes, we see the blue dye. With a little radioactive detector, we can detect which lymph nodes are radioactive, and that allows us to pick up the sentinel lymph nodes, the first two or three in the drainage pathway. And the studies have shown that by evaluating those sentinel lymph nodes, if they have cancer in them, then often we would consider doing a full axillary dissection. But if
meaning removing all of the lymph nodes.
Correct.
Yeah. And that's when women get into trouble with lymphedema.
Right.
But if those nodes are negative, then you can stop.
Then you can stop, right. And so a sentinel lymph node surgery has a much lower lymphedema rate, probably in the 6 to 8% range.
When you are in the operating room, can you find out if that sentinel node is positive or negative right away?
Oh, yeah. Our pathologists look at everything intraoperatively, and if the sentinel node is positive, then based on that information, we can decide whether or not that patient needs a full axillary lymph node dissection and get everything done at one operation.
Wow, what a boon for so many women. But still, if you have had to remove all of the lymph nodes because multiple nodes were positive, and a woman has had radiation, I'm sorry, you said the incidence of lymphedema was what?
So definitely that's kind of what we call the double whammy. If you have to have the full axillary lymph node dissection and axillary radiation, up till recently, I would have quoted that patient probably around about a 35% risk. What this study looked at was essentially, we used the Rochester Epidemiology Project, so basically looking at a patient cohort, basically all the women who resided in the Olmsted County area here in Minnesota, and looked at those women who had breast cancer and looked at who developed lymphedema. And we did show that in those patients who had an axillary lymph node dissection, they had a higher rate of lymphedema, about 15.9%, than those who had sentinel lymph node surgery. Their rate was lower, in the 5% range. But importantly, what we also showed was that nodal radiation was an additive factor, as was chemotherapy.
That nodal radiation means that they had radiation over their lymph nodes?
Exactly. Okay. Radiation to that area where the surgeon had removed the lymph nodes. So really what we're seeing here is that this is a multi-insult that the patient is going through, and that's what's leading to their lymphedema risk. So the highest risk patients are those patients that have the most advanced disease, because they are the ones that underwent an axillary lymph node dissection. They also had radiation directed to that area, and they received chemotherapy.
Mm-hmm. That's the triple whammy.
It is. And, you know, in the past, I think we've always acknowledged that surgery has an important culprit. I think we've acknowledged the role of radiation. Chemotherapy, if you dig into the literature, there have been a few studies that have noted that chemotherapy increased lymphedema risk, but it's not really something that's commonly known. And so I think what we see is patients come in and they talk to their surgeons about lymphedema risk, but it's not necessarily something that they always talk to their medical oncologist about. Now, by no means does this mean the patient shouldn't have chemotherapy or shouldn't have an axillary lymph node dissection, but I think what this study highlights is it can help us identify who are the patients at the highest risk. Those are the patients, those patients that have an axillary dissection and axillary radiation and chemotherapy. We should maybe be following those patients a little bit more closely, being a little bit more active in the lymphedema prevention, lymphedema clinic evaluation, and educating them to come in early if they have any signs or symptoms of swelling on the arm lymphedema.
If you're going to develop lymphedema as you're going through this cancer treatment, is it usually right away? I mean, do people develop this later on? Is it just usually right at the time when they're going through all the other stuff?
It's a lifelong risk, but most people will develop it within the first 2 years if they're going to develop it. So there's the, you know, those first year or two is kind of the critical component.
So if you're a female who's been treated for breast cancer and you end up having lymphedema, you can't blame it all on the surgeon.
Spoken like a true surgeon.
Dr. Judy Bowie, Mayo Clinic surgeon and researcher, thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you.
And that's our program for this week.
For more information about topics discussed today, visit us on the web at Mayo Clinic News Network, where you can access a podcast of today's show, previously aired programs, and the latest news from Mayo Clinic.
Have a question about health and medicine for one of our Mayo Clinic experts? Tweet us anytime at hashtag Mayo Clinic Radio or send us an email at mayoclinicradio@mayo.edu. We'll be answering your questions in upcoming programs.
You've been listening to Mayo Clinic Radio on the Mayo Clinic News Network. Our producer for the program is Jennifer O'Hara. For Mayo Clinic Radio, I'm Dr. Tom Shives.
And I'm Tracy McRae.
Thanks for joining us.
Any medical information conveyed during this program is not intended as a substitute for personal medical advice, and you should not take any action before consulting a healthcare professional. For more information, please go to our website, radio.mayoclinic.org. Please join us each week on this station for more of the medical information you want from Mayo Clinic specialists who know.